The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. At least it is Friday morning here in sunny California, where we are located in the San Francisco Bay Area, actually Sonoma County in Petaluma. Welcome to the Space Show today. I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very, very much for tuning in. Today we have a show focusing on one of my favorite, and I believe among the most important of all topics discussed on the Space Show, national security space. And we'll get into that more in just a minute. But I do have a couple of quick announcements. The first announcement is we're doing a 60-minute program, but we will go longer if you have emails or phone calls for our guest today, Sam Wilson, who has been on the show several times, and we're fortunate to have him back today. But we are planning and looking at the 60-minute format, but we can be flexible and go longer. And the second announcement is that on Sunday, Leonard David, the great space journalist that has been on the show since the founding of the Space Show, is returning. His wife, who is also an incredible space educator and outreach person, Barbara, is going to be on with him for at least part of the show, or maybe all of the show. So Leonard and Barbara are both great guests, and hopefully you will tune in. And I think Leonard, I think there's a lot of deans of space journalism, but Leonard is right up there at the top. I don't think anybody's on top of him, but there might be some people close to him, or maybe in your mind or others' mind, even equal to him. But to me, Leonard has a special place in space journalism, and it's really a treat to have him back on the show. And then another announcement is I'm facing another eye surgery episode, this time on my left eye. So the week of April 5th, there will be no shows. So that would include no Tuesday program, no Hotel Mars, and no Friday program. And I will be returning to the Space Show that Sunday. So I just want to clear, it's already on the schedule and blocked out, but I just want all of you to know that. And then one more announcement, and this is already on the upcoming show menu. Right now, it's the last item, or the bottom item on our upcoming show item, and that is on April 1st, and this is not April Fool's. I know that's April Fool's Day, but this is the real McCoy at 6:30 p.m. California time. So for those of you on the East Coast, that's 9:30. The AIAA, San Francisco Northern California Regional Chapter, is doing a special program and interviewing me, because we're coming up on 20 years of the Space Show. And Fremont John, as many of you know him because he calls the show quite a bit and posts on the blog and helps me get guests, otherwise known as John Jossi in real time, and Kim of Moonwords are going to be interviewing me. This is free, but you do have to register. And if you go to the upcoming show menu, as I said, the last item is the AIAA promotional flyer that you can read about the program, and it tells you how to register for the program. It will be archived on the AIAA YouTube channel. They will provide me with an audio-only archive for the shows, and they will provide me with the video, which we will put on the Space Show Vimeo chapter. But if you want to be live, and if you want to ask questions, there is a moderator, Eric Wall, and he will control the input of questions. There's about a 15 or 20 minute Q&A session at the end of a 45 to 60 minute interview with John, Kim, and myself. So I'm going to start promoting this because hopefully lots of you will log in and participate and see it live. And this is not the typical interview I get about why did you start the space show and stuff like this. We've been rehearsing it and making it go deeper. And it includes people like John and Kim, because without guests like we have today, without callers, without listeners, without sponsors and supporters, there really is no space show. I'd just be putting on my headphone and talking to dead air. So it's a give-and-take session and kind of beginning to celebrate 20 years of the space show. So hopefully all of you can tune in and listen. So for today, back to reality, Sam Wilson is back with us. He is a policy analyst at the Aerospace Corporation Center for Space Policy and Strategy, where he is responsible for leading work on the international space, nuclear command, control, communications, and missile issues. His full bio is on the page, and you can read about him. You can call him at 866-687-7223. You can email at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And real quickly, before I turn it over to Sam, keep in mind that The Space Show is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we rely on listener funding to support The Space Show and make programs like this possible and to bring them to you. So there is a huge PayPal button at the top of our homepage. That is the easiest way to support The Space Show. But for all the old schoolers out there, such as myself, you can make a check out to One Giant Leap Foundation, that is our parent, excuse me, and you mail it to The Space Show at P.O. Box 95, Tiburon, California, 94920. We are tax deductible for your gifts if you pay federal income taxes, and the same is true for California state taxes. So again, listeners just like you, keep The Space Show going, and we hope that you will support us. We do have sponsors, as this is a shorter formatted show. I just want to shout out to our great sponsors, although they do get that banner ad running across the homepage: Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Astrox, AIAA, Moonwards, Celestis, and the National Space Society. If you're interested in being a sponsor, having a banner ad, and having your messages and your name put out there on every single Space Show message, please, at my Space Show program, excuse me, please email me for information at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Sam posted a paper, it's from January of this year, at the Center for Space Policy and Strategy, and it is linked on our blog. And the paper is titled, The Hypersonic Missile Debate. I have been following this subject for quite a while. I've heard interviews with people talking about it in terms of China and our Pacific Fleet, retired General Jack Keane, for example. It concerns me. It interests me. And this is an absolutely excellent paper, defining options, defining strategies, the problems, and a little bit about the technology. And we're very fortunate to have Sam back with us to help guide us through what may be a very, very important national security issue that this administration and future administrations are going to be facing. Sam, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you today?
Thanks, David. I'm well. It's great to be here. And congratulations on hitting 20 years. That's a really incredible achievement.
Yeah, so it's actually around June 1st is 20 years. But AIAA is doing this program. And I can announce I'm now in the progress of, I've actually started the Space Show book about 20 years of the Space Show, plus a little more. And I figure I have the 20th year to work on and to complete it. So that would be shooting for completion and some kind of printing, undecided yet, by May 31st of June 2022, which would be the start of the 21st year. So that's my goal.
Wow.
If hypersonic missiles don't land in Sonoma County and wipe me out. So, so tell us about this problem and introduce us to it.
Yeah. So, thanks again for having me. This is actually my third time on the show. So it's always really a pleasure to be here. So this topic, I think, of hypersonic missiles is a really kind of tricky one to navigate unless you're immersed in missile issues. And one reason why I wanted to write this paper, which really I think people might be asking me my opinions in the Q&A, you know, what I was seeking to do here was to kind of offer an objective lens, right? Like what do these debates mean? Can we try to unpack some of the strategic objectives from the technological assumptions kind of embedded within the positions on hypersonic missiles? Because, you know, if you're just following this issue in the press, you're gonna get very kind of Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde impressions of the missiles. I point out in the paper that headlines about hypersonic missiles have characterized them as unstoppable, blindingly fast, and as capable of deadly accuracy. But there are also headlines that have characterized them as being ballyhooed, a mirage, hype, and just not accurate. Right? So unless you are a aviation missile expert, how do we sort out this debate, right? Like, how do we try to figure out whether hypersonic missiles are for the U.S. perspective, a good investment moving forward, and kind of what the levels of that investment should look like? And if you're thinking about the U.S. perspective, you know, what about Russian and Chinese hypersonic missile developments? How have they changed the nature of the threat environment? So what my paper was trying to do was trying to answer this question by just showing, you know, where the different views were and trying to categorize those views, and then kind of pull apart, what I call the kind of strategic aims, which are kind of the military objectives of what you want to try to achieve with these weapons, and the technological views of kind of what is the unique advantage of hypersonic missiles versus other types of capabilities. And something else that before we just to wrap up this your first introduction of the topic is that even the term hypersonic missiles is really misleading, David, because, you know, many other missiles that are not called hypersonic travel at hypersonic speeds. You know, missiles called ballistic are traveling at more than 5 times the speed of sound, which is what is called hypersonic. So what hypersonic really means, what it's really referring to are two types. One are called glide vehicles, which is the kind that's the most technologically mature at this point. And that's, you're seeing some of the fielded capabilities in Russia and China being in this glider capability. And then the other is a scramjet system, so air-breathing engines. So basically just really fast cruise missiles. So you have hypersonic glide vehicles and hypersonic cruise missiles, but the idea of a missile traveling at hypersonic speed is not new, right? Like that's existed for a really long time. You know, one thing that's a little bit distinct about these weapons is the combination of speed coupled with really heightened maneuverability. So being able to fly at lower trajectories, being perhaps able to make really big glide turns, which could make a missile more evasive and harder to defend against. But those points are disputed too, right? Like there isn't a consensus technological perspective here. In fact, recently saw this debate happening in the press where there was a piece in the New York Times that was questioning a lot of the technical claims made by the weapons, made on behalf of the weapons. And then you have these pieces that came out in Breaking Defense that were a lot of U.S. officials debunking some of those attacks from the New York Times. So, again, I think it's a hard debate to navigate. And to me, you know, my big takeaway from the paper is that you should, in order to kind of make sense of this debate, you should stop thinking about the technology and start thinking about what you would want to achieve. I think there's a strong correlation between folks who are advocating for large numbers of hypersonic missiles and who want to be preparing for a mainland missile war against China, for example. And then I think there's a lot of correlation between folks who think, you know, we shouldn't be investing in, or we shouldn't be deploying hypersonic missiles, and people who think that, you know, preparing for or focusing on a mainland missile war against China is a really scary proposition, and it's so risky that it could, you know, it could raise rather than lessen the likelihood of conflict. So I think that question is really important of, you know, what are our military ambitions vis-a-vis Russia, but really predominantly China. And I think that question helps answer where a lot of people fall on this question of hypersonic investment and hypersonic deployment.
What actually exists and what, if anything, has been deployed by China and Russia, or possibly the U.S.? Have we deployed anything, or are we behind the development eight ball?
Yeah, we haven't deployed anything. Russia, one of the programs that's gotten a lot of attention is a program called Avangard, which is a Russian program which, from Russian silos, can reportedly reach continental United States. And that's a glide vehicle program. And then China unveiled weapons actually in 2019 at their big military parade that they said were hypersonic weapons as well. That was the DS-17. So there have been some Russian-Chinese reported deployments, but on the U.S. side, we're still in the development phase.
So the DS-17 is operational and has been deployed by China to some degree?
I mean, all I really know is that, yeah, China has, you know, showcased these weapons at their military parade. But I think there was a U.S. China threat report that came out that probably has a more definitive. A few months ago, that probably has a more definitive answer, but I'm not exactly sure if they're deployed, whether they're fielded, whether they, you know, where they are, but they were showcased in 2019. And at that point they were, you know, they looked as if they were a fielded capability.
I have a question for you. So this is, Jerry, and Jerry is emailing from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And he says, David did post a link to your paper on the blog, and I have read it, and I've listened to your introduction. So here's where I have a problem. I'm assuming that it is either a fact or not a fact that the weapons exist and their capabilities are more or less known. So, but what I'm understanding you to say is that the policy analyst, military as well as national security, maybe as well as political, have turned the analysis into something subjective based on their beliefs. The facts don't care about people's beliefs. They're either dangerous as hell and we can defend against them, or some variant of that. So how do you reconcile the way different positioned people and policymakers believe versus the facts and the reality on the ground?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, I think this is where it's really important to be really careful when you're looking at, commentaries about the missiles, because you need to see what are these missiles really advantageous for certain missions, or are they really scary from, from a adversary perspective because they can do certain things, or do we think they're not different than other missile capabilities for other reasons, right? So it's really important to try to figure out what, you know, someone who's writing about this, what do they think hypersonic missiles should do? Because getting at that missions question, I think it's really important to getting at that technological question. So I'll use a comparison between hypersonic glide vehicles and other missile capabilities. So something that I think is really also confusing about this is that when hypersonic missiles are often discussed and written about, there's usually this differentiation of hypersonic missiles and everything else, right? Like, what is a hypersonic missile? What is a glide vehicle, right, compared to another type of missile? And those lines almost always understate the broader missile environment, right? So these lines, there's lines that'll say something like, hypersonic missiles as opposed to other types of missiles are fast and can maneuver, or can maneuver a great deal and can travel at hypersonic speeds. But the truth is that other missiles can also travel at hypersonic speeds and can maneuver. We actually had another report that came out over the summer. It was the end of August, where we had a missile. We presented a missile taxonomy, and we showed that, look, there's a lot of missile capabilities that aren't called hypersonic glide vehicle that can maneuver, that pose extreme challenges to U.S. defenses, but are not and are traveling at hypersonic speeds. And that could be, you know, they might be able to do aerodynamic maneuvering within the atmosphere, which is something that glide vehicles can do. But they might also have, you know, kick motors or some sort of power function that allows them to maneuver exoatmospherically, right? Like the way that an ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile with multiple reentry vehicles is setting off those reentry vehicles into different locations. And that could mean, you know, the difference between, if you're looking at like a Russian system, that could mean the difference between an attack on New York or Atlanta, right? So, and no one is saying an intercontinental ballistic missile has maneuvering capability like a hypersonic weapon, but the truth is that there's a pretty important delta between what you expect a missile to land and what actually that missile is capable of. And that's a system that's existed for 60 years, right? So, you know, I think a lot of the skeptics of hypersonic weapons are more pointing out that this delta between what is a hypersonic glide vehicle and what is something else doesn't really exist, right? Like, hypersonic weapons may not be, because they're maneuvering within the atmosphere, that's also going to slow them down. So that's another characteristic of the weapons. But it's not a simple, I mean, going to your question, it's not a simple answer of whether they pose a significant delta from other weapons or whether they do not, right? Because, you know, the real point is, what are those other weapons? You know, China also has, we talked about the DS-17, they have the DS-26, the DS-21D. Those are systems that can target, that are reportedly can target our ship, right, or our carrier destroyers. That means that they're able to probably do some sort of outside the atmosphere adjustment, and then use aerodynamic maneuvering to actually get to the ship itself. So, you know, there is a whole spectrum of missile capabilities, and hypersonic missiles, our glide vehicles predominantly, are receiving a lot of attention, but it doesn't mean that, you know, everything else isn't also extremely threatening. So I think that's one part of the answer to this question. But it's also, what do you want to be achieving with your missile capabilities? Are your missile capabilities trying to target, ships? Are they trying to penetrate Chinese integrated air defense systems and hit at crucial systems in their mainland? Is it trying to target things like mobile missiles in China? Because that's going to make whatever you need from a missile capability more precise and harder, right? So some people who are like, you know, I don't see a mission. Some people say, I don't see a mission that gliders would be uniquely qualified for as opposed to other missile capabilities. It may be that they don't agree with missions that other people say that we should be doing with those missiles, right? So it's really important to figure out what these missiles are going to do. What are the operational concepts that you're buying into? What are the missions that they support? Before kind of figuring out, okay, should we deploy thousands of these things? Should we deploy hundreds of these things? Should we not deploy any? And I think in answering that military objective question, again, it really helps you answer that technological question.
How do you grade the United States so far, or is all of this classified and there's no way to grade the United States and how we're dealing with this issue?
I mean, again, it depends on, you know, whether you think, you know, some people think that, okay, China and Russia have gliders that can defeat defenses, but they've had other missile capabilities that can defeat our defenses for a really long time. So what, right? So I think that's a crucial question that we have to has to be answered, right? Is,
uh-huh.
is the so what? Just because, you know, we may not be able to defeat hypersonic glide vehicles, does that mean that we can defeat other types of missiles? You know, I would say that, you know, gliders pose different types of challenges for defenses. I mean, the thing that makes it, to me, that's particularly destabilizing about heightened maneuverability and glide vehicles are kind of represented kind of an extreme case in terms of heightened maneuverability coupled with high speed, is that you just don't know where they're going to go. So even if we accept that, you know, they're able to carry out missile strikes with other missile capabilities, at least you have space systems, right, that are detecting, that boost, that infrared, that rocket burn, and then you're seeing, and then you have some idea of where they're going, and so you can characterize that attack and know how you should prepare, right?
Uh-huh.
When you don't know where it's headed, it makes it really hard to figure out how to respond and how you should prepare. So, you know, I think that is destabilizing. I think this push, for all missile systems that makes it more maneuverability in systems would make an actual conflict really, really destabilizing because people, you would force decision makers and you know, the heads of state to make really consequential, inhumane decisions with really imperfect information. Not saying you would have perfect information in the absence of gliders or, you know, other systems that can maneuver to a great length, but you would have it would be a little bit narrower what those missile capabilities could do. So, you know, that's something that I think is really concerning.
You have a caller on hold. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you, please, and where are you?
This is John of Fort Worth.
Hi, John.
Yeah, when you talk about these, there's been a lot of focus on the carrier type weapons that China has, but I'm just wondering, can the Aegis SM-3 successfully intercept those things? I mean, that would seem to be, one of our defense weapons we would use against that, right? And it does have anti-ballistic missile capabilities.
Yeah, great question. I think it's not super clear, partly because, you know, you have some new systems that are coming out, and that, you know, again, we have imperfect information, and a lot of the theories about what hypersonic glide vehicles can do is about kind of what their potential would be, right? I just think, you know, SM-3, that's a terminal system, so that's kind of looking at that last phase. you know, some people argue that could be really effective against gliders, because gliders might be traveling at a lower speed than other types of missiles, even though they're traveling at hypersonic speeds. If they're going to actually conduct maneuvers within the atmosphere, that's going to slow them down. So perhaps they might be easier to destroy than others. Some other people say, no way are they going to be easier, because they can maneuver really right up until the end, and they're going to be able to, they're capable of these really big swoops and glides and banking turns. That's going to make it really hard for defenses. So it's an open debate. I think which speaks to so many of the challenges, the frustration of the last caller who's like, this, these should be facts. You know, it's so early that there aren't really facts yet on this. There's some facts, right? But I think if we get caught up too much in sort of, you know, debates about what the aerothermal heating probability is, or, you know, what the circular error probability is, you know, these technical considerations, we kind of lose sight of what the actual debate is, which is the strategic debate. You know, do you want to be focusing on kind of defeating Chinese systems on their mainland, or do you think that, you know, that type of mission is overly escalatory? And then from there, we can kind of think whether hypersonic glide vehicles or other systems would be the best capabilities to achieve that mission.
Let me step in before you ask another question, John. How do you practice, or is this all done through computer simulation? I mean, to see if you can defend against a maneuvering missile. I mean, there's no maneuvering missile to fire and test your hardware. So what is this, all computer models and simulation?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'd have to get back to you on that, David. I have some semblance of that, but I'd have to talk to our missile defense folks to get a more concrete answer.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead, John.
Well, okay, and another area I think is talking about the Russian system. I sort of see what they're doing is, well, first of all, the Russians always have this sort of extremely paranoid defense conservative attitude toward the world anyhow. And I think what they're kind of worried about, and they seem to be worried about it, is the idea that the U.S. would at some point break out of our, you know, non-ABM defense posture. I mean, we have a limited intercontinental ballistic missile defense capability designed probably against Korea primarily. And even that's a bit iffy. And I think, but they're looking at what if we actually made a major investment in it, particularly during, you know, previous years. And I think they're just trying to develop a capability that they could expand if we were to do that. That's sort of my view on what the Russians are doing.
Yeah. And that comports with what a lot of, I think, prominent thinkers in this area agree, right? That if you look at, you know, Putin has said this himself, that, you know, he was developing these programs in response to the U.S. withdrawal from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty in 2002, and that they were perhaps worried about the idea that the U.S. could develop space-based intercept. And, you know, the thing about gliders is that they can travel at really low altitude, so that, you know, their trajectory looks much different than what a parabolic trajectory that you kind of associate with a ballistic missile. So because of that, you know, space-based intercepts may not be as effective, because they'd have to go much further to reach them. That's if, you know, space-based intercepts were ever an effective thing, if they were ever an actual thing. So there's a lot of, like, really hypotheticals and what-ifs in that baked in. You know, I would just say something that has been striking to me when I've talked to Russians about this. I did a, you know, track two dialogues in Moscow before the pandemic. And, you know, the focus wasn't even about missiles. It wasn't, you know, my presentation wasn't, it wasn't even about missile defense. It was about space. And so I was talking about, you know, U.S. perspectives, or my perspective from the U.S. side,
about, you know, what were some of the destabilizing things we were seeing in space from the Russian point of view. And they just started yelling at me about missile defense, right? Like, they just started yelling at me about space-based missile defense. I was like, well, wait a second, guys. We don't have space-based intercepts. And they would point out in the 2019 MDR that it says that we're going to pursue space-based intercepts. So there was a lot of, so there does seem to be genuine fears on the Russian side about those capabilities, even though those capabilities don't exist. And I think that ties back to 2002 when we left ABM Tree.
Yeah, yeah. I saw a show once on their mobile SS-25 missile, and they were actually worried about tactical aircraft going in and targeting their mobile launchers when they tried to deploy. And I said, well, these guys are really, you know, very, very nervous.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's one of the things about it. But yeah. One last thing before I'll clear the line, let you go on with everything you're doing, is that another type of hypersonic has been discussed by our former president, which sounds to be more of a tactical system that could be launched from an aircraft and would go in at ultra high speed compared to the current, you know, cruise missiles and things we have, but would be in the hypersonic area. And I don't think we haven't quite touched on that and what its situation is.
What missile are you talking about?
Well, the missile that President Trump was touting is an air launch missile, and he misquotes it 17 times the speed. No, it's not that fast, but it's some kind of tactical missile that could be launched from an aircraft that would go in at very high speed, and that's under development, obviously.
So the U.S. is considering several different. I mean, the U.S. has several different programs, development programs for hypersonic weapons, including sea-launched, air-launched, and ground-launched. So, that's the air-launched program. The air-launched development is definitely part of what the U.S. is looking at right now.
Yeah. Something to defeat their SS-400 or SS-500 interceptors, I assume, and hit targets and things like that. I assume it, Well, there's a whole field out there, that's for sure. Well, I'll clear the line, see if anybody else wants to get in on this discussion.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Listeners, John has cleared our toll-free line. If you would like to call 1-866-687-7223, what is the relationship of the hypersonic missile to space? So my understanding is hypersonic stays in the upper atmosphere, doesn't go into space. So how does space come into play?
Yeah, great question. I think I'm glad that you asked this, David, given that we're talking about hypersonic missiles on your space show, because there is a really interesting convergence of space and missile issues. First of all, the vast majority of space launch vehicles, have origins as missiles, right? Like a space launch vehicle and a missile are both rockets. But, the historical connection is particularly striking for hypersonic glide vehicles because, more than four decades ago, the U.S. used rocket boosters to launch a high-tech glider that traveled at hypersonic speed. And that glider was called the Space Shuttle. And the success of that program generated interest in the possibilities of hypersonic travel within the atmosphere. So, I'm glad that you asked that because, this does have a real connection to space. The space shuttle was in many ways a glider, but it was outside the atmosphere, and that prompted ideas of what could a glider look like within the atmosphere. And it also shows that this isn't something new. The U.S. has been looking at this for several decades and has been investing in this for several decades. And I think part of what has spurred a lot of the interest as of late is some of the Russian and Chinese development. And then also the heightened, U.S. funding numbers that have come over the last few years. You saw a huge jump in funding, in that kind of 2019 point, 2018 point when Michael Griffin came back to the Pentagon. So, you know, I think it's, you know, there's a lot of connection to space. And David, just one, you know, one other bit I would just note is that, you know, so much of this debate is also about missile defense, right? What do you think U.S. missile defense can do? Where do you think Russian and Chinese missile defenses are going? Because, including their air defenses, because that I think also, you know, helps determine whether you need a glider or whether you could use less expensive systems or other types of missile capabilities, right? Like, and so, you know, this question of you know, the technical, again, this technical debate is partly a debate about where you think what are U.S. missile defenses are capable of, but also where you think Russian and Chinese defenses are going.
You have an email from Wayne in Houston, Texas, and he says, I think part of the concern, at least from what I can tell from the press and from TV interviews of people who are supposed to be experts, is that these hypersonic missiles are nuclear capable. How does that enter into the picture, or are you going to say lots of other missiles that have almost the same capabilities are also nuclear capable, so no new deal here?
Yeah, and I mean, just to clarify, this isn't necessarily my view, right? I'm trying to show you different views in this debate, but yeah, so the Russian Avangard program that I mentioned, that's nuclear capable. You know, I think it's, you know, there's on the Chinese side, you know, I think some people are saying they're pursuing mostly conventional systems, some saying they're pursuing a mix of conventional and nuclear. It, you know, again, I think, you know, even the 2019 Missile Defense Review, which was a bit more bullish or more ambitious than the previous Missile Defense Review, did say that, you know, the U.S. is going to remain vulnerable to Russian and Chinese intercontinental ballistic missiles, right? So, you know, from one perspective, okay, we were already vulnerable to nuclear-armed capabilities on our homeland, on the continental United States. So does this really change anything? I mean, the argument that it does is kind of what I talked about earlier, that you really just don't know where they're headed. You know, you don't know whether a system, if you have no sense of where a system is going, it's hard to prepare, it's hard to know how to respond until very late in the game. So I just think that makes, you know, the job on decision makers really tough. However, for even, you know, the other intercontinental ballistic missiles, as I pointed out, we don't necessarily know where they're headed either, because even though they're following sort of a parabolic trajectory, you know, because they have those reentry vehicles that, you know, with and they're using power to launch them to different locations, that creates a huge delta from, and, you know, as I pointed out, New York, Atlanta, Chicago, Houston. So, you know, you don't really know where it's headed. So there's a lot of challenges with those systems. I think, you know, again, a crucial question is, where do you think U.S. missile defenses are going at the homeland level? Do you think U.S. missile defenses at the homeland level are getting close to being able to intercept those Russian and Chinese systems? If so, then you think that, you know, intercontinental gliders that are nuclear capable may change warfare. But again, it's built on assumptions of where you think U.S. missile defenses can go with other systems and with gliders.
What if they make the wrong assumption?
Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, the wrong assumption means either you're more vulnerable than you would have been otherwise, or that you're spending a lot of money that's not necessarily changing the nature of the threat, right? So, you know, I think that's what's really hard. Yeah, and also kind of where you think the action-reaction cycle goes. You know, so there's some people, And this kind of ties into views on, like, you know, lessons, different interpretations of the Cold War, even. You know, I think some people say, look, in 2002, the United States pulled out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, and that prompted Russia to start investing in new ways to hold our mainland at risk because they were concerned about where U.S. missile defenses could go. So, you know, in some ways, U.S. prompted this. Other people say, you know, that's total nonsense. Russia and China are always trying to hold us at risk in different ways, and the only way we can kind of stop, you know, their ambitions is to have such dominating capabilities that they know that they can never win a conflict. So, you know, this idea, you know, that there's this tension between whether some of our developments in kind of this nuclear strategic space spur Russia and China to pursue scarier developments, or whether they're free, they feel empowered to pursue scarier developments because we're not doing more. You know, so that's just like a really hard question to answer. And you know, I had people who I spoke with, and I wasn't even asking them about the Cold War, but I had some people who said, just volunteered, look, this reminds me of the Cold War. You know, the Cold War is good evidence that, you know, to Russia and China that they can't win a strategic conflict with the United States, that we will outcompete them and they will lose. So the United States should go kind of, you know, full steam ahead on hypersonic offense and hypersonic defense, and Russia and China, you know, will try to compete, but they won't be able to, and they'll know that. And then there's the other people who I spoke with said, look, this reminds me of the Cold War, you know, where we were just building lots of weapons sort of unnecessarily, and we got to the point where, you know, the Soviet Union and the United States had, you know, tens of thousands of weapons each, and it didn't increase our level of security at all. We were just pursuing this sort of arms race, and we were just doing it because the other was doing it, and we got to this really untenable scenario that luckily didn't escalate. But, you know, so you know, people are using the same period of time, the same scenarios, and drawing just completely different conclusions and applying that to hypersonic missiles and the sort of hypersonic missile competition, which again, I think shows that, you know, in some ways this debate is about our different worldviews, and so we shouldn't be caught up necessarily in some of these technological back and forth, right? Like, if we start thinking about the missions that they support, then what missions we think are appropriate to pursue and which maybe not appropriate to pursue, we can better answer this question.
So here's what concerns me about all this, and I'm clearly not a military strategist or a national security guy or a weapons guy. But number one, when we outcompeted Russia in the Cold War, we had a hell of an economy. So right now, our economy is a hell of a sick economy, and we've got major problems in inflation and mounting debt that is soaring. And we may or may not be able to outcompete China, for example. And I think that that's largely being ignored. But that is a reality of where I sit. The second reality is the consequences of a bad assumption could mean your fleet is destroyed, could mean that you've lost whatever combat action you've engaged in. I mean, big-time loss, not like Vietnam, but really big-time loss, not just in terms of hardware, but in terms of deaths and soldiers, maybe the loss of Taiwan, maybe who knows what. So the consequence of losing could be astronomical. So I think what concerns me is that all of these policy wonk people, they're sitting there playing with consequences of this, consequences of that, and I don't get the impression that any of them are grounded in reality of this turning into a shooting hot war and the consequences of getting your ass beat and the fleet being destroyed. And then what? And yeah, I've not heard you talk about that. It's not in your paper. And the only person I've heard talk about that is a TV interview about 2 weeks ago with retired Major Jack Keane, who said the consequences for our fleet in the South Pacific are pretty much annihilation if we don't deal with this problem. and that costs us Taiwan. It costs us a lot more, and who knows what it costs for mainland United States and more. So to me, the policy people got their heads up in the clouds. I could have said something else, but the reality, Sam, of making the wrong assumption is a life and death reality. So
for sure.
How do the citizens make sure, or are we powerless, that these people who are making these decisions and assumptions don't just have their heads up in the clouds and understand the realities of what their bad thinking might lead to?
Yeah. It's a really good point, and I will just say I have my head in the clouds at all times. Not just when I'm talking about this debate, but I do think the other side is talking about life and death too. And so I'll just present two different scenarios, and I think these different scenarios speak to different worldviews. So, you know, there is an argument that I think a lot of, the hypersonic missile debate is often a proxy for, how much emphasis we should be placing on mainland missile strikes against China, right? So let's take one scenario. We have hundreds to thousands of hypersonic missiles deployed in theater, and we're targeting Chinese systems. We're targeting Chinese surface-to-air missiles. We're targeting their command and control nodes. We're targeting their radars, right? So we feel confident because we're threatening them so much that they will not initiate a strike on us or do something to invade Taiwan or try to attack our fleet, for example, right?
Uh-huh.
There's an argument that's one argument, right? This is what we should be doing because this protects our forces. The converse argument is that by doing that, by putting all these missiles in theater, that's extremely threatening to China, and that could initiate a conflict that may not have actualized otherwise, right? Instead of, say, focusing on maritime assets or thinking about counter missiles to be targeting their maritime capabilities, their ships, we're actually talking about targeting their key systems on their mainland, and that might be so threatening to them that they might be a little bit more paranoid and a little bit more quicker to pull the trigger on when tensions are escalating. And now you have a lot of batteries that may not be protected as much, right? You have a lot of missiles that are there as opposed to ships. And so it might be a really tempting, really lucrative target for China to pursue. So the really, this debate, I will just say for myself, even though it sounds up in the clouds, it is about, it is about life, right? It is about, like, whether we think this type of a force, a heavy dependence on missile force, is more likely to preserve lives versus a force, an alternative force that's not focused quite so much on mainland missiles. And that debate, I think, is really hard. And, I mean, I would just respond to the general, too, that, the hypersonic missile debate does, there is something about, hypersonic missiles absolutely could take out ships, but other missiles could, too. I don't want to act as if, I mean, they do have BF-26, BF-21s that are capable of exo-atmospheric and endo-atmospheric maneuverability that are labeled as anti-ship missiles or carrier destroyers. So, I don't want to act as if, just gliders that can do these things. But I think a more fundamental question is how do we want to architect our force? What do we think is a better way of trying to prepare ourselves for a contingency with China, given that they have major nuclear fleet, right? Like, given that, you know, this is different than other countries because of the risk of nuclear escalation, right? Would you be willing to attack, you know, 300 sites on China in a conflict, knowing that, you know, they still may have nuclear weapons that they could use to attack cities and the states, right? Like, these are really, really hard issues, and everybody's trying to think about how to preserve, like, how to manage that scenario as best we can.
How do you see the hypersonic missile debate unfolding? Do we end up with a cohesive policy and hardware is being made and deployed? Is that the outcome, or is it just an ongoing debate? And while the debate is going on, we're doing R&D on this and R&D on that, and maybe something gets deployed, maybe we give up on some other thing. What is the resolution of the debate? Does it create a policy? Does it create an action plan? Does it create hardware?
Yeah, I mean, I think we shouldn't be just consumed with the technology. I don't think we should sort of reflexively mirror Russia and China. I think we need to first think about what we want to do with missile forces. What does that strategy look like? And so, you know, hopefully now the Biden administration will think about whether, you know, how to configure the force to meet its strategy. I think it's just unclear precisely what that's going to look like. I think there's always going to be R&D in these systems, but, you know, as opposed to plans to deploy thousands of weapons or to deploy a niche capability or deploy none at all or deploy somewhere in the middle, you know, that should be a strategic choice, not just a technological choice, right? I think there should just be a deliberate decision. This is the type of force we want to have because this is the type of scenario we're preparing for, and these are our perspectives in that scenario, rather than, wow, hypersonic missiles can seem to be this really compelling widget. Let's try to get ahead of where Russia and China are. You know, I don't know where that gets you. I still think you could end up in a scenario where you're deploying thousands of weapons, but I think you want to at least have that strategic rationale to get you there, rather than just say we need to beat Russia and China on this technology contest. You know, I don't think that is necessarily the best way to approach these weapons. Because, you know, all the money invested in this means less money invested somewhere else, right? And so, you know, the Defense Department's got to weigh those trade-offs seriously.
Barbara is in Salt Lake City. And she said, aside from the military side of hypersonics, we've been hearing for years about hypersonic point-to-point transportation. Are we even close to being capable of something like that? Is there any relationship in a hypersonic point-to-point vehicle to the missiles, except for size or something of that nature? What can you say about tourism or transportation via hypersonics?
Yeah, it's super interesting. I mean, I know that Virgin Galactic is thinking about this. You know, I would say this hasn't been really the focus of my research, but it's a really interesting question. And, you know, I frankly don't know how much some of the private companies are leveraging what's been happening. You know, what is the research in the public sector on this? You know, I think, you know, I don't have a good sense of beyond kind of what's in the press about, you know, SpaceX and Virgin Galactic being interested in hypersonic travel. But no, I mean, it's super interesting. I mean, and again, you know, it's worth tying that back to the space shuttle, right? Like, you know, this, you know, I think a lot of the R&D here isn't going to necessarily just be advantageous for weapons. You know, there's, you know, the glider, was the inspiration, or the space shuttle was in some ways the inspiration for this. And there will probably be civilian offshoots, that will be, you know, that there'll be benefits of this R&D. Again, you know, my focus is more on, you know, I think a lot of the money is going to be in determining, you know, how many of these systems do we want to deploy, if any. And that's where, you know, I think, you know, the Department of Defense really needs to have a view of what it wants its force to be able to achieve before kind of setting those numbers.
While you haven't focused on it, would the capability to distinguish a hypersonic transportation vehicle from a hypersonic missile, maybe going through in a hotly contested area, would that be an easy thing to distinguish?
I think so. I mean, as long as, I mean, I, you know, I think it's not likely that, you know, Virgin Galactic is going to be, you know, taking off. I don't know what the rocket is going to look like for that type of travel, what the boost would be. But I mean, I think it, I would be skeptical that that would create kind of escalation risks. I think that, you know, Russia and China's, their satellites are going to have some indication of where weapons are versus where civilian aircraft are. So, you know, they're not, even if you had this huge boost, you know, they're going to know that that's for civilian purposes.
You have Linda in Seattle, and Linda says, if we just look at the 4 years of the current administration, will this debate be settled, and will there be a policy, or is this just ongoing and you only get bits and pieces of a policy during the ongoing process, but there really is no end point?
Yeah. I think you're going to probably have, I don't know. It's really hard to say. I do think in some ways the next 4 years are really critical. So partly because the last few years there was just a huge uptick. And you had some folks in the Trump administration, in the Trump Department of Defense, that, you know, were pretty open about, you know, how sanguine they were about these capabilities and where they thought, you know, what the future levels should look like. So, you know, I think it'll be, these 4 years will be really telling to see whether that's a continuation, whether that's a break, whether it's a sharp break or a soft break. I don't know. It's a great question. And, I'll be watching intently to see, for any clues on where it's going to go, but I don't know how black and white it's going to look.
Alan is in Oklahoma City, and he says, during this program, you've talked quite a bit about the Navy. Is there a role for the Space Force and the Air Force and the Army in this decision making, and what are their roles?
Yeah. So right now, all three services or all three departments have funding for the hypersonic missiles. So, you know, there's some of the current programs. I think I mentioned there's an air launch program that's under the Air Force, a ground launch program which is under the Army, at least one ground launch program under the Army, and then you know, a sea-based capability which would be owned by the Navy. So you have all three services interested on kind of the offensive side, and then, you know, in Space Force, definitely, you know, on the defensive side, you know, there's a push for because of hypersonic missiles and other missile capabilities, you know, having a tracking layer where you can you can be able to see the missiles wherever they are. So to have a many more systems and kind of a proliferated orbit, you know, looking at missile flight to even systems kind of detecting where those missiles may be launched. So definitely the space element is huge here. You know, right now we have space systems that are detect the boost of missile launches. And, you know, you have capabilities also looking at tracking and that could become much more robust in the future, you know, given, I think, some of the emphasis on how maneuverable some of these systems are.
You have another email from Bill in Los Angeles. And listeners, there still is some time if you would like to call us rather than using email. I know many of you are working at this hour, but anyway, it's 1-866-687-7223. Bill says, I have read your paper, and you pretty much listed four scenarios. I'd like to know how anyone accepts or chooses a scenario that you labeled avoiding the race. How in the hell can you avoid it? And do you have a favorite position for yourself?
Yeah, great question. So I will, in order to be an objective author on this, that's kind of laying out these different perspectives, I will not opine on where I sit. But, you know, the logic of avoid the race is kind of two tenets of the logic of avoid the race. One is that you don't think these systems provide much difference from other missile capabilities, right? So on the offensive side, you think that, you know, the U.S. shouldn't be investing money in these systems. And on the defensive side, you think, you know, Russia and China, all the things that people are talking about that are scary with hypersonic weapons, this was true before hypersonic weapons. You know, they could target our fleet. They could target our mainland. So, you know, we shouldn't overreact to Russia and China developing some of these systems. That's on kind of the technological side. And then on the strategic side, you know, they say, look, the reason why they may have pursued some of these systems is because of stuff that we were doing that made them feel more insecure about their nuclear deterrent, right? About our trying to undermine, you know, these notions of mutual assured destruction and mutual vulnerability that have been kind of this animating principle in nuclear relations thought. And so because of that, they developed these scarier systems. So if we were to develop new offensive systems that, say, target, you know, their mainland capabilities, that's going to spur them to develop other systems that are going to hold us at risk in other ways, right? And if we develop defenses against these things, then they're going to develop the next scary thing that's going to hold us at risk in even worse ways that are sort of unimaginable to us now. So, you know, the best way to approach this is to do nothing, right? Is to say, you know, look, they're developing these systems. Yes, they can hold us at risk, but we were held at risk anyway. So we don't really need to spend money on this. And anything that we do spend money on, with respect to kind of holding Russia and China at more at risk, is just going to make them spend money that's good, that we're also going to dislike, right? So, you know, we should just kind of accept the kind of traditional view on the relationship between nuclear countries, between major nuclear countries, that, you know, everybody can destroy one another and just sort of move on. You know, that may be uncomforting to you, but I think that's their logic.
Is that,
you know,
a
both on the technological side, they're not so worried about these systems, and on the strategic side, you know, this doesn't change anything.
Is that a popular position?
I would say, you know, there are a lot of the people that are writing about this. I mean, I think the two views on this that get the most attention are the two views on the end. You know, I lay out four approaches to how I think people are thinking about hypersonic weapons, and the most hawkish approach is what I call get ahead, and that's the opposite of this view.
Correct,
and then the least hawkish approach is called avoid the race. You know, and that's the view I just talked about. So, you know, I think those two are probably the at least when you're following the suppress, the two views you're most often getting, right? Which are either saying these capabilities are revolutionizing warfare, or these capabilities have a negligible impact on warfare, right? You're getting very extreme different descriptors of what the weapons are and their effects. And I think it's because people are coming from one of these two worldviews.
So either number one, get ahead, or number four, avoid, those are the two most popular.
I mean, I would say, I don't know if they're the most popular if you talk to every expert, but I think if you just look at the headline, I think at the headline, you know, who's writing about this, it's usually one and four. You know, my second and third approach are more focused on defense. There's obviously a lot of focus on defense, these systems. But I think what is generating most of the attention is the offensive side.
You have another caller, and I have an email from Todd that I will do after the caller wanting to know about rogue nations and what they're doing. But let's see who our caller is. Hi, caller. Welcome to our program today. Who are you, please, and where are you?
This is John in Fort Worth again.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I've been.
Hey,
I think about the Chinese situation, to get into that specifically, which is a little. Well, it's about certainly strategic. It's the fact that the Chinese have been fairly restrained in their strategic nuclear force deployments compared to what would be possible. I mean, even looking back to the U.S. and Russians in the, you know, in the 1960s and what we were able to deploy in that period, you know, if they were to deploy something like a Minuteman class missile, you know, and just make out hundreds of them, they could really join the parity club fairly quickly, you know, and they haven't really done that. So provoking them can be an issue there, you know.
Yeah. I mean, there is, there are a lot of different competing interpretations of why China has a smaller nuclear fleet. You know, I think there's, you know, one view that they didn't have, you know, fissile material was an issue. I think recently there's been some work kind of showing that fissile material is not the issue, that it's more just kind of deliberate strategic decision. It is interesting, you know, why they don't have as big of a nuclear fleet, and it's probably their conception of what, you know, of what they think that maybe a nuclear war is not, you know, is not likely, right? Like that, you know, it's, you know, you need enough forces to kind of hold the other at risk, but you don't necessarily need the same number, you don't need to have the max number of nuclear forces in the world, or at least parity with Russia and the United States. They clearly have opted for a different kind of force posture, a force posture that is making it, creating complex systems in theater to make it harder for us, for our power projection, you know, for our forces there. So, you know, they have focused their resources differently. And, you know, and I think, you know, again, it just shows that you don't have to imitate your adversary, right? You can think about, you know, your unique geography, your unique strategy, your organizational construct, and then develop a force from there, which is just, you know, to a great extent what they have done.
Yeah. The other aspect I think of that is that we really don't have quite the interface with them like we had with the Russians in terms of the NATO Warsaw Pact showdown in the Cold War. And the Taiwan is the big issue. I mean, really, where there really might be a shooting conflict, conceivably Korea. But, you know, beyond that, I mean, we're really, you know, it's not like we really have a border where we're going to put large forces against each other. And the real question is, if they were to try to invade Taiwan, could we stop them with naval forces? I think that's the real, and air forces and so forth. That's the real dilemma that has been discussed, right?
Yeah. And the question is, does that require, hundreds to thousands of missiles deployed in theater, right?
Yeah.
Or does that make a conflict more likely? You know, I think that's a big question. You know, there are some people who have said, well, we should deploy, a number of hypersonic missile systems to do kind of precisely what China is doing with us, which is targeting their maritime assets. You know, China is an up-and-coming maritime power, so, it might be a high-value return to kind of think about, well, with our missiles, we could target their maritime assets without necessarily targeting their mainland, which could be more provocative. There are other people that say we should target, their destroyers and their ground, base, radars to kind of take out their integrated air defense systems, and then allow kind of some of the traditional elements of the force to take a bigger role. And then there are other people that say we should be deploying, thousands of these things, and we should be targeting everything from, their command and control nodes to their surface-to-air missiles to their surface-to-surface missiles, everything conventional or nuclear. We should be targeting with hypersonic glide vehicles in theater. So, there's a full spectrum of options there, and you really just need to sort out what you want to do, what you think gives you the best chance of preventing conflict or winning a conflict.
And the question also would be, where would we deploy all this stuff? I mean, Guam is one thought, but I mean, it isn't like a lot of good land bases that are outside of the range of, a thought occurred to me, a really radical thought just crossed my mind. What about a fleet of small submarines like the ones Germany has sold to Israel? Conventional, smaller submarines that could be, but still have pretty good endurance compared to the ones back in the battle days, of World War II. They could be deployed in the Taiwan Strait and preclude a successful land invasion by simply torpedoing the transports. I mean, it wouldn't be nearly as provocative, but it might be a deterrent that wouldn't really, it wouldn't have as many escalatory possibilities, if you will.
No, you're absolutely right. That is one of the alternatives, right, is to a mainland missile fleet is to be thinking about precisely that. You can be focus more on the periphery, focus more on, a war of attrition. War of attrition, a more protracted form of war, blockade, that type is going to be slower, which maybe you think is desirable in a war, in a conflict with a major nuclear adversary. And this is going back to this question David had earlier about, human life, right? These are questions all about kind of how do you think this war is going to play out? How you need to configure the force. And again, my view is just figure that out before, either saying we're going to have zero hypersonic weapons or we're going to have 3,000, right? I just think, sort that out and then build the force you want to carry out the missions that you think are important.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, I'll get off the line if anybody else wants to have some last-minute interaction.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it. Listeners, John is exited, and we'll be on for another couple of minutes. If you want to try to get in a call, it is 866-687-7223. As I want to read Todd's email, Todd from San Diego said, do any of the rogue nations, Iran or North Korea, have hypersonic programs going on? Is there a concern with any of them?
Yeah, I mean, a big question about this is, what are the proliferation risks, right? When do you have other countries pursuing these systems? And, one argument for U.S. defenses is that U.S. Homeland Defenses, the hypersonic glide vehicle, is that even if you don't want to be targeting, even if you want to kind of respect the kind of traditional mutual vulnerability, mutual assured destruction concepts with Russia and China, what about when North Korea and Iran get these things? you know, it could take a long time to develop defenses, so we should start thinking about defenses now. You know, North Korea and Iran, to my knowledge, nothing I've seen suggests they have programs yet, but certainly other countries are being involved. You know, there's been talk in the press about France, Japan, Australia, and other countries looking at these systems. So I think RAND did a report a few years ago where they said, you know, within 10 years, it's going to be really hard to prevent these things from being proliferated. I would also just say, you know, more fundamentally, you know, North Korea and Iran have systems that can maneuver aerodynamically now, right? They have systems that can, you know, so if you know, a lot of our concern is about speed, the speed of hypersonic glide vehicles coupled with our maneuverability. Well, you know, right now North Korea and Iran have, you know, missile systems that are traveling hypersonic speeds and are maneuverable. So they don't just have ballistic systems. So, you know, it's not just gliders, right? It's the kind of whole spectrum of missile capabilities, and they're definitely getting more sophisticated systems.
Is there anything we've overlooked or missed or that you think we should discuss in the final minutes of the program? Have we left something out?
No, I would just encourage people to look at the paper and kind of think through where they would fit. David, it's a real pleasure to be here. I always have fun on this program. You have such good questions. You have really great questions. Everything from kind of from John and Fort Knox asking very specific questions about force structure scenarios to questions about civil applications, about hypersonics, to kind of how we got here, to where I fit in. So I was really, really impressed with the questions and, as always, have a lot of fun with you on the show.
What is your next paper for the Center for Space and Policy Strategy?
Yeah, so I'm looking at some protected satellite, some NC3 nuclear command and control satellite questions. So specifically, one that is probably farthest along is kind of thinking about, you know, should we be, you know, what are the nuclear risks of keeping conventional and nuclear systems on the same satellite? So, should we disaggregate? Should we split systems? The U.S. is starting to move in that direction. How far should we go to make it harder for, you know, Russia and the United States to target or for a conflict to sort of inadvertently cross nuclear threshold because, you know, they may be targeting a conventional capability. So that's the next big project for aerospace. And then Matt Simon from CSIS, and I have a paper, a piece coming out in the Bulletin for Atomic Scientists magazine in May about looking at the Cold War as some examples for risk reduction diplomacy that we can start thinking about in the space domain. So you had this, for 7 years, you didn't really have any space security-focused dialogue between Russia and the United States. You've now started to get some of those back. But we talk about kind of why that's important from a space perspective because of trying to prevent sort of inadvertent escalation and having some operator-to-operator communication links in the event of a crisis, right? So it's trying to apply some lessons from the nuclear world in terms of preventing a inadvertent escalation to the space domain. So that'll come out in May.
Well, let me know when they're out, and I'd love to cover them on the space show as well. I really appreciate your coming back. We'll get this uploaded and posted, and I'll send you the information probably in the morning California time. But it's great talking to you, and I'm glad we brought the hypersonic missile debate to the space show, at least for this almost 90 minutes. Actually, we almost did do the full 90 minutes.
Yeah,
absolutely. So we'll look forward to talking to you again down the road. And for John who called and all of you who sent in emails, thank you very much for doing that. It is a weekend, so everybody have a great weekend, and please do stay safe and well and healthy. And as always, keep looking up. So goodbye from Sam David and the Space Show.